From West Virginia to New Mexico, Oregon to North Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Paul J. McNulty is now president of Grove City College, but he served as the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia and was a leader in our nation's response to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. He joins us for a look back at events of that day. Did Dr. Anthony Fauci mislead Congress when he claimed the United States did not help fund gain-of-function research at the Wuhan lab? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Certificate of Need laws. What are they, and have they made the COVID-19 pandemic worse? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets the answer from Matt Mitchell of the Mercatus Center. And as we commemorate the events of September 11th, 2001, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA recalls a September 11th from an earlier era. He has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It has been 20 years since terrorists flew planes into the Twin Towers at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and heroes foiled yet another attack by crashing a plane into a field in Somerset County. Paul J. McNulty now serves as president of Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, but during his tenure as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, he prosecuted key players involved in planning those attacks. Paul, welcome to American Radio Journal. Paul, you played a very integral role in what occurred in the days after September 11th, 2001. But I would first of all be interested in hearing your remembrances of that day and also remind our listeners what took place and the seriousness of the event.
That morning, I was at the Department of Justice. I was a senior Department of Justice official. President Bush had nominated me to become the U.S. Attorney in Eastern Virginia, where eventually the terrorist cases would be sent for prosecution. At that time, while I was awaiting confirmation, I was serving with Attorney General Ashcroft as a senior advisor. I had been responsible for the transition of the Department of Justice from the Clinton administration to the new administration and had worked closely with him for those first 9 months. And so the morning of the attack, I came to the Department of Justice for what I thought would be a normal Tuesday morning. It was a beautiful day in Washington, D.C. area, as it was in all of the Northeast. And I had actually just dropped off two of my children at their school. And as I was parking my car at the DOJ garage, the first plane hit the World Trade Center number one. And it was reported first instance as bizarre, unusual accident, tragedy that occurred. And while I thought that was very interesting, got out of my car, went into the Department of Justice. And by the time I reached the suite of offices I shared with the Deputy Attorney General, Larry Thompson, the second plane hit the World Trade Center Tower 2. And so together, he and I recognized that America was under attack. Attorney General Ashcroft was actually in Milwaukee at that point, as were other cabinet members who were doing school-related presentations on that Tuesday. It was a kind of education week, and we remember the famous scene of President Bush being down in Tampa in a classroom when he learned about all of this. So we immediately had to jump into action. We had to evacuate the Department of Justice building. We had to locate ourselves to a command center to begin to coordinate the Department of Justice and FBI response to the entire attack. And it was at the Department of Justice command center where I watched on the big screen TVs that we have in this sort of high-tech room, the crumbling towers. It's also where we realized that Flight 93 had crashed into the Pennsylvania field. And so some of the things that were most memorable unfolded as we were watching them in that command center. And then the rest of the day for us at DOJ was really about beginning a criminal investigation and trying to find out whether or not there were any other attacks underway, which was an interesting and a difficult process in itself.
You referenced in your answer, Paul, that you ended up prosecuting some of the terrorists as the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. Tell us a little bit about that experience, who you prosecuted, and how you even began to go about conducting that sort of an investigation and prosecution, because I can't imagine that there was a lot of precedent for this.
That's for sure. I mean, there had been some terrorist attacks, and there was the World Trade Center bombing of 1993, which incidentally had been inspirational to terrorists as they were thinking about trying to hit America on its own turf again. But Zakarias Messaoui was an Al-Qaeda member. He was someone who had, like the other 19 hijackers, become radicalized in different places, and then an educated person who then sought to be a loyal member of Al-Qaeda and loyal to bin Laden. And he was sent to the United States to get training to fly an airplane. So he took instructions in flight, but particularly in Minnesota, to learn how to fly, or to actually not even learn to take off, not really learn to land, but just learn to fly, which was alarming to the instructor. But on a simulator up in Minnesota, this was happening in August, a month before the attacks. And it was the alarming nature of his instruction, where he didn't even yet fly, knew how to fly a small plane, but he was learning how to command a 757. And that alerted the flight instructor to call the FBI. He was subsequently arrested and then held on an immigration charge. And so on the day of the attack, Zakarias Messaoui is sitting in a jail cell in Minnesota. And he was supposed to be, if they could have pulled it off, piloting a fifth plane, which most likely would have gone to the White House, since we think Flight 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania, was going to the Capitol. So as we began to understand what happened on the day of September 11th, the FBI quickly realized that the person sitting in a jail in Minnesota was connected to all of this. And day by day, we saw those connections just become clearer and clearer. He was moved from Minnesota to New York City to be a material witness for the initial investigation. But then the decision was made, he could be indicted as a co-conspirator, since he knew what was going on and had been part of the larger plan cooked up by Al-Qaeda chiefs, particularly Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for responsibility for the entire attack as a co-conspirator. And then it was decided that that case should be brought in Eastern Virginia for a number of reasons. And so he was moved to Alexandria, Virginia in December of 2001, and we indicted him. And we also sought the death penalty against him. And so at that point, our case involved everything about 9/11. And we had a very large team of FBI agents and victim witness outreach coordinator types and a team of prosecutors. I think at times when we looked at the people who also were working on just document controls, we had nearly 100 individuals working on the investigation. And the case actually took 4.5 years because we were seeking the death penalty. He was fighting us on that punishment, but taking responsibility, actually admitting to his role in the overall conspiracy. And so what we really ended up doing was presenting a case to the jury for a decision to execute Zakarias Messaoui, but not to hold him guilty, since he pled guilty to the charges in the indictment.
We are talking with Paul J. McNulty, who is president of Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. Also, as we've been discussing, he was the U.S. attorney who prosecuted a number of those who participated in the attacks of September 11th, 2001. And Paul, one of the things we want to do is we now are observing the 20th, commemorating the 20th anniversary of these attacks, is to remember the victims. Talk a bit about the victims and how we can honor their memory, why we should honor their memory.
It's such an important factor in all of this, because we will spend time at the 9/11 anniversary to remember what happened. But we really have to honor these individuals who, in a sense, died for all of us. If you look at the fatwa that was declared by bin Laden in 98, he basically said to all of his followers, to every Muslim, that was the audience that he was addressing, he said, your duty is to kill Americans everywhere, anywhere. And so and he said civilian or military. And so he was declaring war against the United States and declaring war against all Americans. Now, thankfully, only a tiny number of individuals, extremist terrorists, followed his declaration. But they were out to get any of us, all of us. And so that day, those nearly 3,000 people who died essentially took the bullet for the entire country. They were the people who were going about their business.
Remembering the events of September 11th, 2001, with Paul J. McNulty, the president of Grove City College. Paul, thank you again for taking time to be with us.
Loman, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth. Some interesting developments in the nation's capital this week involving Dr. Anthony Fauci. We're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Of course, Dr. Fauci has been highly controversial. He's been in a running battle with Senator Rand Paul, who himself is a doctor. Some new developments this week in that feud. Want to tell us about it?
Let's actually wind back the clock a little bit first and think about the public trust that was placed in Dr. Anthony Fauci at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. So here's a guy that's received all sorts of accolades in his position as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And he, in December of 2020, was actually appointed by President-elect Joe Biden to be the chief medical advisor to the president. I mean, this guy has been the face of the American effort to stop the spread, slow the spread over 30 days, to mask, to vaccinate, all the messaging that's come out of the White House. And now we're learning that Fauci has been at least concealing part of the truth to the American people.
Rand Paul, of course, has been suggesting this is the case now for quite a while, Scott. Can you go into a little bit of detail about exactly where the inconsistencies or perhaps outright lies have been?
Yeah, so it was reported this week through a Freedom of Information Act request by The Intercept that detailed grants that the U.S. government's scientific agencies gave to an outfit called the EcoHealth Alliance. And they funneled some of that money to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Dr. Rand Paul has been questioning Anthony Fauci within several hearings. They've had a couple of viral moments that I'm sure many of the listeners have seen. And Rand Paul claimed that the NIH knew about this funding, but Dr. Fauci said, quote, that they had not ever and do not now fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And he said if anybody was lying, that it was actually Dr. Rand Paul. Well, the documents obtained through that Freedom of Information Act request reveal that at least two of these grants through EcoHealth Alliance have helped fund gain-of-function research. And if anybody's wondering, like, what exactly is gain-of-function, right? Gain-of-function is the ability through microbiology to increase transmission of viruses from animals to humans. And that's exactly what happened. This Wuhan Institute of Virology was studying the transmission of SARS diseases from bats over to humans, and then they had the outbreak. And of course, at first everybody said, oh, it was a natural outbreak at a wet market, right? But we all know that that's total crap. And the bottom line is, since Fauci has been peddling these lies for 18 months, his fame has dramatically risen. He threw out the first pitch of the Washington Nationals game when baseball resumed. He has been out there. Now he's going to have a book that he'll make millions of dollars on. And Fauci actually makes more money than the President of the United States. He's got a waiver within his position for what his salary can be. And so Fauci is getting rich off this idea that the coronavirus is something that we can control through masking, through vaccinations, through social distancing. But he knew all along that the information coming out of the Wuhan Institute of Virology meant that this was gain of function, meant that there was highly increased transmission of the disease. What Anthony Fauci needs to do, he needs to resign his position. If he's unwilling to resign, Joe Biden needs to fire Anthony Fauci. And if Joe Biden's unwilling to fire Anthony Fauci from these two positions, then the Congress needs to go ahead and impeach Anthony Fauci. Did you know that you can actually impeach civil officers of the United States? And that means somebody that's been appointed to a position. And that would actually be Anthony Fauci. So it doesn't just go to elected members of office or judges. It can certainly extend to senior officials like Anthony Fauci when it comes to impeachment.
Efforts to determine the exact origins of COVID-19, of the coronavirus, have been inconclusive, in part because obviously the Chinese government is certainly not cooperating with our efforts to discover exactly how this occurred. The degree to which Anthony Fauci has apparently not been totally honest about it, is this frustrating efforts for the American public, for the world to really know how this even began?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's become a political issue. Half of the country thinks that it began in the Wuhan Institute of Virology as a gain-of-function research, and I think that that's what the evidence is pointing to now, that it was funded through U.S. taxpayer dollars. And then half of the folks believe the propaganda coming out of China, and they also have this problem that a lot of the information is classified. So perhaps that's why Fauci felt compelled to lie before Congress, because he was privy to information that was classified. But the bottom line is Americans deserve to know the truth, how this deadly coronavirus sprang from China, how it really has mutated into different variants that are even more deadly than the initial Alpha variant. Now we've got Delta, and then we'll have Lambda. You know, this is going to go on and on, just like a flu that mutates. And if we're ever going to get ahead of it, if we're ever going to get the U.S. economy completely back to normal, if we're ever going to get our schools and our kids back to normal, we need to confront the facts that are born through this information. And we also need to remove people from positions of public trust when they have completely broken that trust with the American people.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, a couple of words about the club.
Sure. The Club for Growth is an organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we're focused on economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. And if your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually join and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, chat with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Certificate of need laws may be responsible for making the COVID-19 pandemic worse. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the issue with Matt Mitchell from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
We've seen a lot of stories in the media during this Delta wave of the COVID-19 pandemic about hospitals, particularly in the South, running out of ICU beds or having a shortage of facilities to treat people who have COVID-19. But one factor here, one that's often overlooked, is the fact that many states, including Alabama, is a state that gives government regulators significant control over exactly how many hospital beds there are in the state. And that's a problem even when there's not a pandemic. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Matt Mitchell. He is a senior researcher at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He joins me on the phone now to talk about this issue. He's been really one of the top researchers, I think, in the country in looking into these government regulations that limit the supply of medical care. Matt, thanks so much for your hard work on this, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell me a little bit about these things called certificate of need laws and what they do.
This is the kind of regulation that if it didn't exist, you wouldn't believe that it exists. So what happens is if you are a healthcare provider in one of 35 states in the District of Columbia and you want to open or expand your facilities, you want to add another hospital bed, maybe you want to start a neonatal intensive care unit or a drug or substance abuse facility, you've got to go before regulators and prove that your community needs the service in question. So they're not going to ask you anything about your qualifications, your safety record, the adequacy of your facility, anything like that. Their entire purpose is to second guess your assertion that the community could use the service. And what's most controversial about them is that in most of the states that have these, your potential competitors may serve on the board. And even if they don't, your potential competitors have a say in whether or not you will get your certificate of need. In other words, they can come before the board and oppose your application and say, you know, all else being equal, I don't think we need another service here.
And I guess it's probably not that surprising to learn that this means you end up with fewer facilities, right? In this case, fewer hospital beds, because a neighboring hospital might say, hey, those guys, they don't need more hospital beds. We've got plenty over here.
That's right. So this is an extraordinarily well-studied phenomenon. There have been over 70 peer-reviewed academic studies assessing the effect of certificate of need laws. And the most studied aspect of it is the supply of resources. And so what we find is controlling for other factors, states that have certificate of need requirements, the average patient in those states has access to fewer hospitals, about 30% fewer ambulatory surgery centers, about 14% fewer rural hospitals and rural ambulatory surgery centers, fewer hospice care facilities, dialysis clinics, imaging services, cancer treatment centers, and in this case, hospital beds. And what we found is hospital beds during the pandemic, sure enough, unsurprisingly, were in shorter supply in con states relative to non-con states.
So not just an issue for COVID-19 or for the pandemic, but really, like, if you need any sort of medical care and you live in one of the states that has these regulations, it might be more difficult for you to get the care that you need. The argument for these things, Matt, is that they keep costs down, or at least that was the sort of the initial argument when these laws were passed back in the 70s and 80s, was that the government would make sure that hospitals weren't, like, overbuilding. And then if you overbuild, you have to pay for that stuff somehow, and you're going to end up having to bill your customers, your patients more. And so these con boards were set up to limit how much hospitals would spend and in theory, reduce healthcare spending. Has that worked at all?
No. You described the theory quite well. It was basically just this thought that, you know, somehow if they have all this expensive, fancy equipment, then they'll have an excuse to use it. And particularly in a setting, this is, I suppose, somewhat plausible given the fact that most of us are not medical experts and, you know, maybe we could be fooled into accepting unnecessary procedure. The problem with it is, of course, it also runs against some basic economics. So your listeners will be surprised to hear that somebody actually thought that restricting supply, shifting the supply curve left, would somehow reduce spending. Under normal economic models, if you restrict supply, that's going to raise prices. And sure enough, by limiting supply, by limiting competition, we find that spending as well as per person or per procedure costs are higher in con states relative to non-con states.
We're talking with Matthew Mitchell. He's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center and has spent really years digging into the aspects of the economic and healthcare aspects of these certificate of need laws. Matthew, just about a minute or so left here. I want to finish by bringing this back to the pandemic. There's sort of this sort of supply and demand issue going on here with get these big waves of cases like we just had. It looks like maybe we're finally coming out of the Delta wave a little bit in most of the country. But there are other aspects to these laws that go beyond just the economic function of them.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing, of course, you want to emphasize here is that these are humans. Real people have suffered real consequences as a result of a lack of supply. It's easy to blame the people who are showing up at the hospital for getting COVID because they didn't get a vaccine. And I'm not going to dismiss the relevance of people protecting themselves, but I think in the desire to focus so much on the behavior of patients, we have lost sight of the fact that other things matter as well. You know, there's not just the demand side, but supply side here as well. So what are the rules that are affecting the supply of healthcare? And it, you know, it turns out both factors matter. We find that when there are more cases in the population of COVID, yes, there are greater tendency towards a shortage of hospital beds, but as it sure enough, also when there are things like certificate of need laws that are limiting the supply of care, that also is a factor that limits or that tends to be associated with a shortage.
Yeah, many problems with certificate of need laws. We don't have time, unfortunately, today to get into all the aspects of them, but please check out Matthew Mitchell's work at the Mercatus Center. He and his colleagues, actually, several of his colleagues over there do really terrific work on this issue and on other issues as well. You can find that at mercatus.org. Matt, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, that's Matt Mitchell from the Mercatus Center. You can check out his work, as I said, at mercatus.org. Check out my latest piece on certificate of need laws at reason.com. Alabama's dumb healthcare regulations helped create a shortage of ICU beds. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
September 11th, 2001 is one of the most infamous dates in American history. But another long ago September 11th is also worth remembering. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
This weekend is the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the intentionally crashed United Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. it is often compared to another attack on America, the one at Pearl Harbor that President Franklin Roosevelt referred to as a day that will live in infamy. The term infamy applies equally well to the 9/11 attacks 20 years ago. But relatively few Americans know of another 9/11, one that occurred 244 years ago, less than a mile from where I am recording this today. It was the Battle of Brandywine, and it was America's first 9/11, taking place on September 11, 1777. The Battle of Brandywine was the largest battle of our Revolutionary War, and it was General George Washington's worst defeat. It was also a day that transformed the life of a young Frenchman, the Marquis de Lafayette. He had come to America as a dilettante who was more attracted to the prospect of wrapping himself in the glory of war to dazzle the high society of Paris than he was drawn to the cause of liberty in the British colonies of the newly United States. But the Battle of Brandywine was the turning point in the young Lafayette's life. He was wounded in the leg in that battle, and he could have easily withdrawn and sought medical care, but instead he soldiered on and became an American hero. On October 1 of this year, just a few weeks from now, a book by my friend of more than 25 years, Bruce Maude, will be released. Its title is Lafayette at Brandywine, The Making of an American Hero. It tells a story that will inspire any student of history. Bruce spent hours poring through documents in his original research that are little known, but will now form the basis of a new level of appreciation for Lafayette. I referred earlier to the perception that there is glory in war. The reality is that there is no glory in war, even when victorious. But there are heroes. Lafayette was one on September 11th, 244 years ago, and there were heroes on September 11th, 20 years ago. Todd Beamer is certainly one of them, as he marshaled a handful of fellow passengers to storm the cockpit of United Flight 93 and ultimately take it down, quite possibly preventing a direct hit on either the White House or the U.S. Capitol. There were lesser-known heroes who ran into danger, not away from it, the men from the New York Fire Department. The hate-filled zealotry of Al-Qaeda changed life in America in the 21st century, and we will never be the same. That hate-filled zealotry has surfaced once again this year in Afghanistan, as the Taliban has retaken power and begun a purge in that troubled land that is intended to snuff out their fragile and incomplete rebirth of freedom. Girls and women especially will be subjected to brutalization that will sicken and shock the world. One 9/11, the one 244 years ago at Brandywine, was about rejecting oppression and fighting for freedom. The other 9/11, the one 20 years ago, was an attack on the very symbols of freedom of our nation. And now we are seeing the rejection of freedom in Afghanistan and the reimposition of oppression. Will the world stand by and accept it as a legitimate act of national sovereignty? The Marquis de Lafayette would be shocked if we do. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WZOBAM in Fort Payne, Alabama, WMTA-FM in Central City, Kentucky, along with WMERAM in Meridian, Mississippi. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. Thank you. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.